planning to give a talk. Are there front lights? Just can everybody see? Because it looks sort of like... Oh, okay. So, oh, this looks plausible. Is that okay? Okay. So, yeah, so I'm gonna tell you about this. Random quantum satisfiability, statistical mechanics of quantum optimization. And this topic is a little bit weird. So it's sort of motivated by a lot of stuff that come out of classical statistical mechanics of glassy optimization problems. But it's about a problem which, you know, then is something which comes up in quantum complexity theory. And we introduced the study of random ensembles of this quantum hard problem in order to try to get more of a handle on what makes it hard for quantum computers, and see whether any of these sort of array of complicated glassy phenomena that are known to occur in the classical optimization problems carry over into this quantum case. That's a framework. So what I'm going to do first is, because it's usually a mixed audience, I'm going to give a lightning introduction to the motivation from a complexity theoretic point of view and to the motivation from a spin glass point of view, which is, you know, 30 to 40 years of two different fields of work in about 10 minutes. And then I'm going to start talking about the quantum problem. So the first part of this talk is purely classical, although a lot of the words I'm going to say, if you put quantum in the right place, the statements are the same. So let's just get going. So the starting point for physicists is to say something about complexity theory. So complexity theory, this is classical, complexity theory classifies problems according to how hard it is to solve large instances of those problems. And by large, I mean thermodynamic. You take n to infinity, and you look at scalings of sort of times to the last ground state or computationally find a ground state, determine the solution to a problem. Notice I'm already saying ground state because I'm thinking of almost all my problems as being optimization problems. I want to know what the ground state is of some energy function, which will have local constraints in it. So the two important classes that have come out of classical complexity theory are P, which is sort of simple. It's the set of problems which you can efficiently solve. And the P means in polynomial time as a function of the input size. And NP, which is a class of problems that you can efficiently verify a solution for. And this is a very natural class, actually. It's an enormous class, about it. Pretty much anything that you could hope to write a proof for belongs to this class. And it's natural because if you didn't have an efficiently checkable proof for whatever your proposed solution was, then you would never believe the answer. You wouldn't have any way of verifying that you were right. So this is a very big class of problems, but it has some constraint on it. The big conjecture in complexity theory is that there are hard problems. That is, that these are not equal. Because if they were equal, then any problem that you could efficiently check and write a proof for, you could mechanically find a solution to. So you could have a theorem like the Kaplan conjecture or something, and then just plug it into a computer, and it would prove it. It would solve whether this is true or false. And you wouldn't have to do any hard work, no creative thinking, no nothing. So that's why people believe this. The star didn't show up. There it is. It's a conjecture. But it's a pretty plausible conjecture, because if it weren't true, then there wouldn't be any hard problem, which I don't think anybody really believes if they've been working. So, so then what does this tell us about physics? Let's start transferring over. Well, there's this idea of the Strong-Church-Turing hypothesis, which is, in some language, a computer, that is something that I could do algorithms with that would solve a problem, can efficiently simulate any physical model of computation. This is one of the places where you could insert quantum in a couple places, and the same thing would be now called the quantum structure. But a computer can efficiently simulate any physical model of computation, which is to say that all physical models of computation are equivalent. And a computer or a physical object is something undergoing its own dynamics. So if P doesn't equal NP, that is, there are problems that I can't efficiently find solutions of, then there must be physical processes that can't happen in reasonable timescales. Okay? There's a number of people who try to turn this into something like a second law. They conjecture that this is true and then try to find physical consequences for it. But it's a little bit of a stretch in most cases. But I think this is sort of one reason why physicists should pay attention to this. This is sort of a speed limit to something. It's a very subtle one once you turn it into physics. So the thing that I always have in the back of my mind about this is that I'm thinking about something like simulated annealing, which is like cooling off a physical system, and I can't relax the ground state of certain kinds of systems by any annealing process, by any cooling process, because if I could do it, then I could always solve any problem. Now, let's get a little bit more specific. Let's pick a problem to think about. So let me introduce this problem called three satisfiability. And this is still classical. This is an easing model. I put it in quotes. The spins I like to think of as plus or minus one spins. In that sense, it's easing, but it has no easing symmetry. That is, that if I flipped all the spins, the energy wouldn't be the same. So just a caveat there. There are n bits, or easing spins. There are m constraints. Each constraint involves only three of the bits. So it's like a three-body term. And I can write a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of these energy constraints. Notice that this particular constraint that I've written here, EM equals, oh, I have a hockey stick. I'm going to use my hockey stick. Very exciting. So this particular constraint is saying, I've got a phi 1m, phi 2m, phi 3m. It's saying that spin m1 matches phi 1m, and spin m2 matches phi 2m, and spin m3 matches phi 3m. And if that's true, then this energy is 1. And if any of them doesn't match that phi that I've specified, the energy is 0. So I've only ruled out one out of the eight possible states of those three spins. Yeah, yeah.
Or is it just that the constants are always of these four? Wouldn't it be like the product of the three is equal to some fixed term?
Well, so, yeah, so three sat is, this is an example, I can make pretty much anything out of sums of terms like this. This is a specific example, although this general form is already going to be good enough for us. Okay, so we can generalize it, but this is enough. So what I'm going to say is that I'm going to call states satisfying states if the energy for all the terms is zero. That is, full energy is zero, because these are all non-negative. And so the question I ask is the ground state energy zero? That is, does there exist a satisfying state? Now, this problem is what's called NP-complete. Okay? There are other systems, I'll just say now,
there are other systems that look a little bit more physical in their interactions. They're actually easing, they're more two-body interactions, things like that, which are also NP-complete. But this is the sort of prototypical computer science example, and it's one that we've studied in the quantum context because it generalizes. So let's run with this. Let me tell you, I just said NP-complete, so what does that mean? That means that, well, what completeness means is that it's if I could solve 3-sat in general efficiently, I could solve anything in the class NP. So a problem which is NP-complete is a problem which encapsulates all of the difficulty of the class NP. Okay? So that is to say that 3-sat has a worst-case complexity, which people call, well, which is that it's NP-hard, or NP-complete. This is essentially the key insight of sort of complexity theory, is that problems like this exist, that there are complete problems for various classes, going back to Cook and Levin in the early 70s. And it's actually, it always takes a little while to wrap your head around this idea when you're not used to it. it's not actually that difficult. It's really just a statement that if a problem is in NP, the only thing I know about it in general is that a classical verifier exists, which is efficient. So let me take that my verifier is just some collection of logical gates, because this is some classical computation, it's a circuit, and what it does is it takes an instance of 3SAT and it takes a proposed proof, so in this case a proof is just a claim that this is a satisfied state, with n bits, which are whatever, claiming that it's a satisfied state. The verifier evaluates the energy of that state, which you can do efficiently, and then outputs that in fact that was a correct proof if the energy was zero. And it outputs it was an incorrect proof that the energy was not zero. That's what this big yellow box does. And I can encode the operation of this circuit, the correct operation of this circuit, into an instance of satisfiability. And all that's saying is that I could look in here and look at all those little gates that are in there that make up this circuit that we all implicitly believe we could write down. And just encode in lots of little Boolean steps, which only involve 3 bits at a time, that say this intermediate bit was the correct AND of the previous 2 intermediate bits. And I write down a large Boolean expression, which is that all these things work correctly. And I add a few terms which say that the problem, in fact, is the input set of bits. And I add a term which says that the output is, yes, I believe this is energy zero. And then I ask the question, does that big instance of satisfiability, this big Boolean thing, have a ground state energy of zero? Because if it does, that means that there existed a set of assignments of all the bits, all the intermediate states in this system, including the proof, which made the thing operate correctly, and which gave the output, yes, this is zero energy state. So it's really just rewriting this thing as a 3SAT formula and asking if a ground state exists, which amounts to asking whether a proof exists. And if the proof exists, the problem is, in fact, satisfied. The instance of the NP problem is, in fact, the yes instance. This is the worst case complexity. And there are a lot of natural sort of classical statistical mechanics looking problems that people study, which have this property that their worst case complexity in this sort of general classification is that they are NP hard. In fact, almost every non-trivial optimization problem you can think of ends up being NP hard. Okay, so that's great, but it lacks something. This says that it's hard, I can't solve the general instance. But what makes it hard? What in detail about the problem makes it hard? If I gave you some particular example of satisfiability or using glass that looked ferromagnetic or something like that, you'd say, oh, well, here's the answer. Maybe. Right? Or maybe not. Maybe you can't. So can we tune our attention a little bit, focus it, try to figure out what makes these things hard in a more detailed way? And there are a couple of approaches to that. One of them is to define a whole range of other complexity classes with obscure acronyms that are usually 2 or 3 letters capitalized. That's what most of the complexity theorists do. And the sort of statistical physicists say, no. Let's look at typical properties. Let's look at an ensemble of 3SAT formulae and look at what it does as I tune various control knobs, various parameters on my ensemble. And can we learn something about hard versus easy instances by looking at the properties of that ensemble. Okay, so that's what we have here. The ensemble of 3SAT, it's sometimes called setting its typical case or average case complexity rather than its worst case complexity. Of course, I've just zoomed in a lot. If I pick a stupid ensemble, I may find that all of the instances I look at are in fact easy in some appropriate sense. So I need to pick an ensemble which lets me tune through different difficulty regimes. Okay. So, what this people first started studying this, you can see in the mid 80s. It followed after 5 or 10 years of the study of various spin glass models, Edwards Anderson model, Sherrington Kirkpatrick model, and a bunch of sort of interesting mathematical phenomena that were found to occur in those sort of mean field models of spin glasses. And a lot of those things carry over to these combinatorial optimization problems like this next one. So we'll talk about that in a second. Let me just tell you what the simplest ensemble is I can look at, or that people have looked at with some success. it's this. I pick a clause density, so I fix alpha, which is m over n, and then I randomly throw down m clauses and on my n bits, and then I randomly pick which of the eight possible directions they dislike. So they penalize one of the eight directions that they touch, or eight states that they're the three spins that they touch, and I just penalize them. Okay. So what does this ensemble do? Well, it does a lot. So a glass theorist comes along and he looks at this and either what's called a replica approach, replica symmetry breaking, or in fact more successfully in the last 10 years with what are called cavity approaches, cavity methods. And they come up with this very complicated looking phase diagram as a function of clause density alpha. I should say this is a huge industry among the Parisians, which are the spiritual academic descendants of Giorgio Parisi and a number of people living in Paris. So anyway, let's talk about it a little bit. This is a qualitative phase diagram of random constraint satisfaction problems. I've told you about three set. I can give you coloring problems. I can give you Q-state Fox models, which are basically the same thing. I can give you any number of sort of local constraint satisfaction problems that people have studied in this approach and found a lot of interesting phenomena. So what is this picture? Let's go through it a little bit. As a function of alpha, if I go to the very low alpha regime, there aren't very many clauses. So in general, I expect the thing to be unfrustrated. I expect there to be zero energy configurations. That's what that big black splotch is. So each of so this is phase space. This box is the phase space configuration space. And the black dot is saying that there are lots of solutions, so zero energy space. And they're all connected in the sense that I can walk between them by finite numbers of flips of bits. So I have one solution, and maybe if I flip one bit of it, I get an energy one state, so that wasn't so good. But if I flip two or three, I get back to another of the zero energy states. But I don't have, but, and the fact that this is some big region is actually saying that there is a macroscopic entropy, that there are exponentially many of these zero energy states. So now I tune up my alpha, and the first thing that happens is this various names of these transitions, but the first thing that happens is that I get some kind of public dynamical transition, where I now still have solutions, there's still black up in this square, but there's multiple dots. There's one big dot whose entropy is enormous, and that's what dominates the thermodynamics. So this is not actually a thermodynamic-based transition. It doesn't show up in any thermodynamic quantities. But then there are also other smaller black dots. These are collections of other ground states, zero energy states, which are themselves, I can walk around inside of each of those black dots with few spin flips. But if I want to get from this black dot to that black dot, I need to flip a finite fraction of the spins. So there are large energy barriers to walking between the dots in phase space. Okay? Now, there are each of those black dots has some volume, which is to say it has a macroscopic entropy, but its entropy is completely dominated. The entropy of the full system is completely dominated by the big one. There are, in fact, also, there is an entropy, it's called the complexity. There is a, which is a misleading term, but there's an entropy of the number of black dots as well at various subs. So then we get an actual dynamical, an actual transition where I have lots of solutions, but no single solution or no single cluster of solutions dominates the measure. Now I actually need to keep track of different clusters of solutions in order to get my thermodynamics right. And this is where you might expect that algorithms start finding it harder and harder to find solutions. Because now there are a lot of them, but they're further and further apart. There's less of them in the overall measure. And you could also imagine I'm looking at zero energy states here, but what if I said, what about the one energy states? Well, presumably a similar picture is there, and maybe those one energy states don't actually connect to any zero energy states. And then this landscape that you have to walk through is getting very complicated if you were trying to find an algorithmic way to relax. And then there's actually a transition that is associated with a real cluster. There's some miracles. Where I have a few clusters left, and a finite number of them are relevant for the measure. Things get really hard. And then they all go away. This is a very pretty picture. It shows up. Some of these, if you look through the literature of the last sort of, basically since this paper until now, people have studied lots of different variants of constraint satisfaction problems in this approach and found various variations on this picture, depending on the stuff. But this is sort of the picture. So this is based mostly on cavity methods, a question that we might want to ask is how much of this carries over to a quantum case. This is a very pretty picture. Much harder to interpret in a quantum case because you don't have such well-defined notions of states.
Whether what?
Local.
Yeah, so all of these models are, they're local in one sense, which is they only involve, say, 3, 4, or 5 body interactions, so some limited number of terms in each degrees of freedom in each term. But they're non-local in a geometric sense, because they're all on random graphs, and random graphs have log loops, sort of mix. So, in fact, the simplest way to see the random graphs is that locally random graphs look like trees, and trees are very high dimension.
If you impose geometric locality, what's the picture?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. So that's one of it's the Atlantic divide in glass theory. The finite dimensional spin glass problem, there's a competing theory for it. This is all based on replica symmetry breaking, which probably holds in these mean field like models of trees. In finite dimensional physics, there's a droplet model, and then it's actually open what actually happens. I've talked to a few people, this guy, has worked on what actually happens in finite dimensional physics, whether any of this picture carries over, and it's unclear.
So some pieces of the predictions of a picture like this seem to carry over, but some pieces don't, and there's really not a lot of control, theoretically. So a lot of that's based on numerics.
The 3-sec, looking for the 4, 5, 6-sec, you get the same sort of transmissions occurring.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm not exactly, this picture that I snipped from that paper, that PNAS paper, is actually for Q-state coloring where Q is greater than 5 or something like that. And I'm not exactly sure what the current belief is about ASAP. But for instance, in the Q-state coloring model, if Q is, I think two of these merge into one, if there's like a direct transition from everything between, but for Q greater than 4, it looks like this qualitatively. And I expect similar things happen in the case of this.
But whether these two things are the same, doesn't that also depend on whether the droplet or replica features are?
Well, okay, so all of this is about the random graph model, the appropriate variant of the random graph model for higher k. Right? And in that case, it's almost certainly the replica picture, which is right. Because those are geometrically non-local models. Everything is held up after 30 years of people beating on Parisi's original replica ansatz, and numerics have supported it. So most people believe that this probably is the right thing. And actually, I should say, I left it out. Why is this interesting other than that it's sort of a full picture? You actually can get better classical algorithms for solving optimization problems from this picture. So these cavity techniques that you use to generate the pictures by studying these disorder ensembles, in fact, can be applied to particular instances. And you can use them, it's a sort of equations that are related to a particular instance about distributions of effective magnetizations. And you can use those distributions and you calculate locally by some iterative procedure to actually guess good solutions. And you find that you get algorithms called belief propagation and, more spectacularly, survey propagation, which actually use this picture for particular instances to be able to actually solve fine zero energy states all the way up into these regimes, which you can't do with simulated annealing, which gets stuck earlier on. So this picture has, it holds up under attack, though it's very hard to prove statements about it, some people do. Right. So, actually, I've worked on some of the quantum cavity generalizations a few years ago, but The problem I'm going to tell you about in a few minutes, we don't have a cavity search for a column. So we don't know how to get this out of
here. Pitch across real phase transitions.
Okay, that's a real phase transition. That's a real phase transition. This is not, though it should be, and it's not because of a miracle that happens that this entropy, which dominates the measure here, and the collective entropy, which is the entropy of summing up the right subset of these, actually match. And as far as I can tell, that's a math miracle. I don't know why that happens. Because this is all zero temperature, so I'm really just worried about the entropy. So this looks like it should be, and maybe in some models it is, but in fact, in this model, there's no cusp here in the entropy. And that's sort of a miracle, because you actually are moving over to, all of these things are calculated in the Legendre transform of the entropy. And you move from, you jump where your maximal position is across this transition. That's why the picture changes. But in fact, the value that it takes is the same. And I've talked to a few people about that, and they think it's miracles.
This picture reminds me of the usual figure in the random graph theory. So if you consider, if you fix the edge density and you consider random graph, then the size of the connected components looks like this. And
you know, the actual size of the connected components. In the random graph, you have no giant cluster. The distribution of connected of clusters is, I guess, plus one or something, and the tail gets longer, the mean size gets longer and longer, and then you get a giant component.
And so, yeah, if you change the density of the edges, I don't remember, but if the edge density is less than 1 over log n or something, then there is no. If the edge density is more than 1 over log n, then almost surely there's only one big component and other components are very small. And if the edge density is less than 1 over n or square root of n, there's no one big component. So it's like the picture in the middle. And then, so reminds me of that. But my guess is, there any possible connection between them?
There isn't. So this alpha is actually all order 1 over n. All I'm tuning is the 1 over n part. I'm not going into the sublinear regime or the superlinear regime. Mm-hmm. There are phase transitions as a function of these things, and they get more and more complicated clustering. So in that sense, but I think in detail, these models have a lot more structure. You're talking about what's happening on some decoration of those random graphs, or random hypergraphs in this case. So, and these transitions don't correspond particularly to geometric transitions in the random hypergraph. Not obvious ones. So, anyway, okay, let's go on. Sorry.
This is just a summary. I have this statistical physics of constraint satisfaction. In the classical case, I have worst case complexity. It's this notion of empty completeness. When I start studying ensembles, I get satisfiability transitions, dynamical transitions. I didn't talk about much, but those are called the picture. Clustering transitions, which is what I showed the picture of. This is a cluster of solution space. And then I have heuristic algorithms, which get built out of these sort of the intuitions we get here, which are things like simulated annealing, belief propagation, and circuit propagation. So how much of this is done in the quantum context? And I want to say there are two quantum contexts here. One of them is trying to solve a classical optimization problem using quantum computing. And people have studied that in the context of adiabatic optimization. And there's some contrasting literature there. And one of them is actually trying to solve a problem which is hard for a quantum computer in the same sense that these are hard for classical computers, that is a QMA complete problem. QMA is a quantum complexity class which generalizes NP. That is, that there are quantum verifiers. We can efficiently verify the solution. So anyway, this is the status. There is a notion of QMA completeness. This is the direct analog of NP completeness. There's some number of problems that you can put into this class. There's essentially nothing here. And there's even less here. Because quantum heuristic algorithms that look anything like this are few and far between. Although it's beginning to change. Yeah, and you can't test them. That's true, actually. These are heuristic. So anyway, so let me say that what the next part of my talk is about is basically about this box. So rather than going through all those slides again, which I went through at the beginning of the talk, and just putting quantum in the right places, let me just introduce the problem, which is quantum satisfiability. It's a natural quantum generalization of classical satisfiability. I'll show you that in a second. it has a hard worst-case complexity, which is that it's QMA complete. If I could solve it, I could solve any problem but QMA 1 complete. If I could solve it efficiently with, in any way, then I could solve any problem which could be efficiently verified by a quantum computer. Then the question is, are typical instances hard? And basically, we're sort of hoping that some of all that beautiful stuff that happened in the classical case will carry over this problem and maybe give us insights into the problem itself. So here's quantum KSAT. it's a K-local qubit model. So I have n qubits now. I have n projectors. The projectors just project onto some state in the local K-qubit Hilbert space, the Hamiltonian, which is a sum. And I'm going to restrict to the case where these are rank 1 projectors. That is, they penalize 1 out of the 2 to the K states associated with those qubits. And you can vary that, but for this talk, let's stick with rank 1. Already has a lot of the interesting features. And this contains classical KSAT. All I need to do is make these projectors project onto basis states, computational basis states. Then this is exactly a KSAT Hamiltonian. Okay. Same question. Is the ground state energy zero? That is, does there exist a state in the Hilbert space which is orthogonal to all of those states that I
constraint on the final. Yeah.
Whatever you want. They're just some state.
Are you restricting the phi m to the basis state?
No. If I restrict to the basis state, it's classical case.
Yeah.
So I'm allowing it to be an arbitrary state.
Arbitrary k qubits.
On k qubits. That's right. Okay, so I haven't said much about the picture, but I think it's clear. The green dots are qubits. The red squares are projectors acting on collections of qubits. Yeah.
It had a question when you said that with constraints in the computational basis that it reduces to classical. Is that formal? Because I could see a situation where you're introducing new possible solutions by allowing superpositions on your solution state.
No, it's formal because okay, I can diagonalize this in the base in the computational basis if these things are all basis states telling you. And then it's really just strictly the classical case that energy.
Okay. So,
it doesn't help you. So okay, so let me just say what I already said a little bit. The worst case complexity is that this thing is QMA one complete. So here's a QMA 1 verifier. It has as many lines going into it as lines coming out because it's a quantum circuit. So it's reversible. There's one measurement at the bottom, and that tells you whether or not you should believe this proof. And you can,
it's a somewhat less trivial construction than in the classical case, but you can in fact show that you can encode the whether or not a proof exists which makes this measurement come out being yes, SAP, in the ground state of you said. That's through a mapping to, I guess, adiabatic quantum. Yeah. And let me say that 2QSAT, much like 2SAT, is in P. This is not a quantum P. There's no Q here. There's a classical algorithm which solves it. Whereas k for k greater than 3 is QMA1 complete, so it should be hard. And this is analogous to the classical case, although k equals 3 is actually open. What complexity class is it here? In the classical case, k equals 3 is already open. So, and this is all, this was introduced, all what I've just put on this slide is in a paper, I think it's a long time ago, due to Sergey Bravi in 2006.
Promise about the anticipated evaluation.
Absolutely, that's what that one is.
Okay.
But it's okay. So there is a promise in this problem to say that it's QMA1 complete. To be able to verify that the state is zero energy, or that no, well, I need to be able to verify that there is a ground state with zero energy. But if I only have a polynomial amount of time, I can't differentiate states with zero energy from states with exponentially small energy. Basically. Doesn't look like it in the circuit, you know, when you construct verifiers, but basically there's an uncertainty. And so there's a promise that the Hamiltonians you get either have zero energy ground states or they have a ground state which is polynomially kept from zero. But I'm washing it out because of what I'm about to do next. And in fact, in the ensemble, it probably doesn't matter because the ensemble in the thermodynamic limit either has a zero energy, either so far that we've been able to prove, either as a strictly zero energy state with probability one, or as a thermodynamic energy. And therefore, it always satisfies the promise gap. In the ensemble sense, of always. So, okay, so let's look at putting an ensemble of this. Here, I've got the same random graph with some clause density alpha.
That's the exact same sort of randomness as in the classical problem. But now I also need to tell you what I penalize, which in the classical problem is a discrete choice. Here it's not. It's a continuous choice. So let's take the simplest one we can, which is make it uniform. So now this is a projector on a k-qubit state, which is continuously chosen from, you know, the hard record. Of course, this already looks very different from the discrete case, and it this is sort of key to a lot of what we can say about it with any sharpness. So what's the first thing you can say? Well, I'm clearly anything I'm going to tell you is going to integrate out this projector because I'm making it continuous. So it's not surprising that that means that there's a sort of geometrization result. The thing is either satisfiable or not just based on the graph that I've given, not based on the projector, because the projector has been washed out. So let me say that a little bit more carefully. For a fixed graph G, actually there's no random graph here. This is a fixed G. You hand me a graph. Generic choices of the projector's pi, generic in the sense of this continuous choice, produce instances with minimal set dimension. So whatever the zero energy ground state dimension is, it's minimal with respect to that choice of projectors. Okay?
So that means we can define,
there's a well-defined dimension of the kernel of that Hamiltonian, a set dimension, RG pi. It's equal to some function, this is an integer dimension, just of the graph G, which is the generic result, the probability 1, and this is the minimal result over all projectors. So in general, these things are as frustrating as possible.
It's always one dimension. So the solution is unique.
No.
No.
No. I can't say that in a classical case either. There can be lots of zero energy states. And notice I'm looking for zero energy states. This isn't the ground state dimension. In fact, if this thing is non-zero, then probably it is unique. If the ground state energy is non-zero, it's probably. But if the ground state energy is zero, then actually there's going to be a degenerate subspace associated with it, and its dimension is only dependent on the graph. So this tells you something. Actually, that's just the statement that this holds. And then if I could compute this function, R generic, the generic rank of a graph, I'd, you know, be done with the whole problem. I'd say, okay, that was too trivial. And I can do it for 2qsat. But remember, 2qsat was the simple case where it's not actually QMA complete. So here, I can tell you what this function is.
Clearly, it factors over this connecting cluster to the problem. And if I have a tree on n sites, I get that dimension is n plus 1, with probability 1. If I have one loop in my graph, it's 2. And if I have more loops, it's 0. That's it. And you can prove this by constructing what we call the transfer basis, which is a non-orthogonal basis for the Hilbert space, in which the zero energy states are just symmetric states. And that's where you get this n plus 1. Let me leave it at that. So with that function in hand, I can tell you the whole phase diagram. Well, a little more work. But I can tell you the whole phase diagram for the random graph problem, because I know lots about the random graph for k equals 2. Right? So down here, the random graph doesn't have a giant component. It's made up of lots of small clusters, which are all trees, and a few of them which have a single loop. And so none of them have multiple loops, and so the thing has zero energy states with probability 1 in the large increment. This half is the giant component transition. So here's where the giant component appears. Goes on SAT. Showing that this energy exponent is 2 actually requires you to do a little bit more work. It comes from measuring the size of not the giant component, which has a linear exponent, but the size of the 2-core array, which is basically what you get if you strip off all of the weeks until that becomes one. And then you can actually, well, almost completely rigorously show that this is a thermodynamic lower bound. You can get it to, we managed to get this lower bound to go as n to the 1 minus epsilon. So it's almost linear, provably. So there's your energy exponent. For comparison, this is the classical transition. It's exactly one way. And there's some simple reasons for that, but and the exponent. So this was almost too simple. All I needed was to know some random graph theory and what that function was, which took us a while to figure out originally, but it's not so bad now. But for k greater than 2, I don't have any idea what that generic dimension of a graph is. So if I want to get the phase diagram for this thing, I need to do it indirectly. And I can
show you SAT and unsat phases.
And I can show you something even more interesting, which I'm reserving for a bit later. But in terms of indirect arguments. So to show that at low densities I get a satisfiable state phase, I construct them is the easiest way. So there's something we call transfer matrix states. This is for k greater than 2, so this is a generalized transfer matrix argument. I'll tell you about Dimer-Covering states. This actually completely characterizes product states. And then very recently, a quantum Lobach local lemma was proven, and this allows you to non-constructively also show that there are satisfying states in a somewhat different regime than you get from the Dunn. So I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. And on the unsat side, what I'm going to do is upper bound this generic dimension. Right. So if this generic dimension is less than 1, it's 0, because it's an integer, and that's all I need to do. So what you get are some things that look like a first moment bound, which is sort of classical stat mech, sort of the easiest cut on a ground state entropy. And then the classical bound, which really is just a statement that the quantum problem is always more frustrated than the classical problem, so any classical upper bound is also a quantum upper bound. And then there's something called the sunflower bound, which gives you the best current upper bound on where this unset, or best current, I guess, lower bound on where the unset phase starts. So I'm not going to, this is lots of different stuff. There have been several papers on it since our first one or two. So I'm not going to take you through all of it, but I'll take you through one or two of them just to give you a flavor. So let me take you through this first moment bound. It's the simplest. This is just an iterative bound. All I do is add projectors one at a time and look at how much it cuts down ground state dimension. And so what do I get? I have n bits, no projectors, the generic ground state connections to the end. That's in fact literally the ground state connection. Then I add one projector. Not surprisingly, it cuts this down by 1 minus 1 over 2 to the k. So this is now 7/8 of many states there were before in the ground state, zero energy space. Now I add another one. I get it cut down by another one, 7/8. And then here, this one overlapped with the previous two. So now it's not so clear that it just cut it down by 7/8. But what you can prove, a little bit of work, is that it cuts it down by at least 7/8 with probability 1. That's where you actually have to invoke the generic. The generic has to be protected. And then, well, now you just sort of go through and go to the end, and you find that the mth dimension, which means you put everything in, is less than this, probability 1. And if you put m as alpha n, the generic limit, then you get a critical value of alpha, where this base here is negative. And that tells you that if you've got alpha larger than that, this is upper bounded by something going to 0. And therefore, it's unsat out there beyond alpha weak bound. Let me just point out here that this bound scales as 2 to the k as I grow k, which is something we'll come back to a little bit later. And also, more generally, this step is the key, right? That this holds with probability 1. So you can prove more generally that if I take two sets of projectors, so sort of two subgraphs, and put them on top of each other, that the new generic dimension is upper bounded by an appropriate product with probability 1. You don't actually, there's no equality, but you know that it's upper bounded. So if you use that, and instead of adding single projectors at a time, you add a somewhat bigger cluster, you can get a better bound. So that's what Sergey Moore, Chris Moore, and it's what these guys did. What? Alex.
So it's what these guys did.
A couple months later, it's called the Sunflower. I call it the Sunflower Bound because they look at sunflowers and nosegays, which are clusters, slightly larger clusters than one projector. They do an exact calculation of the generic rank of these subgraphs and then do an analysis of the random graph to figure out how many of these subgraphs they can find inside of it and use that to get a better bound on modals on that threshold. And what's nice about this is that this is already strong enough to show you that the scaling with k is strictly less than the classical scaling with k for the classical version of this problem. And even at k equals 3, this particular value, 3.594, is less than the known classical value. By the way, when I say known, these things are only known in little windows. Nobody knows exactly where the transitions are, although there are some projections. But the windows are pretty small.
How does this correspond to the...
right, so each of these, his picture's a little different than mine. Each of these circles is a qubit, mm-hmm. and each of the triangles is a k equals 3 square. So that's all. So this is a collection of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13 qubits connected by, 6 bosses. So this is called a 6-3 sunflower in their paper. And this is the nosegay, I guess, because it has a central triangle and then petals are around it. So, anyway, this was sort of neat. So now I've shown you how to get an unsat phase.
Let's go to the sat side. So on the sat side, I can construct, well, what can I do to show you that there are zero energy states? Ideally, I'd construct them for you. And I can for certain kinds of them. So I can find a satisfying product state, and I can tell you exactly when they're there and when they're not there. And that's this characterization. So basically, if the underlying graph of interactions with these green qubits and red clauses has a dimer coupling, that is, I can cover a bunch of edges in this graph such that I cover all of the red squares, all the closets, and the covering doesn't overlap anywhere, the hard core diamonds. Then there is a product state that satisfies this thing. No probability, actually. Then there is product state that satisfies it. And vice versa. They're sort of in one-to-one correspondence. And it's a very simple argument for product projectors. I've already put it up there. That's the whole argument. So if I have a product projector, that means, well, I'm looking for product states. So I'm assuming that I have a state which looks like a product state. And let me look at product projectors, where I restrict myself to all the projectors being on the product states. Well, then that looks like that. So if this is to be orthogonal to that, that is that it's got a zero projection by the projector, this condition has to hold. And this is just a product of numbers, which is zero if any of them is zero. So all I need to do is say that this particular clause is satisfied by, say, the first one, which will uniquely specify this because it's orthogonal in a two-dimensional subspace. And then once I've done it, I can't use this guy anymore. But these guys are still free to pair off to other clauses. So if I can do that on the whole graph, that is, I can associate to each clause uniquely a qubit that will satisfy it, then I get a satisfying state. And I've constructed it for you for these product projectors. Okay, so that's why this diamond covering condition is the right condition. Why does it work when I relax the generic projectors? But there's no product state.
Right, so just a little bit of perturbation theory. Let's think of projector space. It's this
M copies of a unit vector in 2D space, some continuous manifold. And here's a product state associated with this point in projector space. So this is some other complex manifold. And the condition, I've written it in sort of components here, for each M, there's a state, now with components, such that this product is zero, because these are product states. You can think of this Z as being, say, looking at the CP1 for the local state, and like coordinates like that, just coordinate choice. And what do? Well, we perturb this and ask if we can follow that. You perturb that by some arbitrary perturbation in this space and ask if we can follow the product state arbitrarily in the product space, right? And so that's a linearization of this condition. And the question is basically, this is some linear condition, so it's a matrix equation. And it's essentially a question of whether the matrix elements here, which are the original phi components, are a surjective map. Because then, no matter what this is,
I can find a way to follow this state linearly. And that's exactly the same condition as the Denver covering condition. Why is that? Because if I look at this matrix of things, then what I need to be able to do is find some,
there are a couple ways to see it, but if you want, I need to find some subdeterminant which is full rank, generically, which is to say that I need to find some collection of rows and columns that I can take the right permutation of to find a non-zero entry, generically. And that's, maybe it's not geometrically obvious. If you think about it for a little bit, it's in fact exactly the same as the Dirac covering. So what this tells you is that if I have a dimer covering, then I have a product state. At product states, I can construct easily. At product projectors, I can easily construct a product state, and I can perturb off the product projectors in an arbitrary direction off the product projectors, and still find a product state. Now I argue that this tells you that in fact there are product states everywhere, even though all I did was check a linear condition. The reason is because this linear condition, if you want to be a little more rigorous, is checking the conditions for the implicit function theorem. And I like thinking that it's perturbation theory. And I can extend this thing because it's an appropriate homogeneous manifold in a complex thickness manifold. So, is that I thought that was sort of, that's one of the neater things. Actually, one of the neat things about this is that particular dimer coverings, if you're in the sort of critically constrained case for product states when n equals m, then I'm going to have some set of dimer coverings potentially. Each one is in one-to-one correspondence with a different product state. And if I can show that those product states for my particular graph are generically linearly independent, then I actually have bounded below the rank of this the subspace. And you can actually, in some graphs, not in random graphs so much, but in some particular graphs, you can actually get a lot of traction from sort of playing with that and looking at, you know, you can prove geometrically that some of these states are independent, and then you really get a basis. It's sort of, so, okay. So the final thing I want to tell you about is that, in fact, here are some phase diagrams, and there's going to be one more line I'm going to add to them. So in k equals 2, I already showed you this, I have what I call product satisfiability because all of those states that I used earlier were, in fact, spannable by product satisfied. And then it goes unsat at a half, and then that's sort of the whole story. For k equals 3, the prod sat regime, this is some random graph arguments now, extends to 0.92. This is where dimer coverings exist up until in the random graph. And then there's a transition where the dimer coverings disappear. The best unsat bound is at 3.59. So this region is open. For higher k, the prod sat regime at k goes to infinity, well, that dimer covering transition goes to 1.
And which is essentially because above
1, I have too many clauses to cover them. Just very simple argument there. And in the large k limit, that's the big of the story. And then the unsat thing scaled, it's 2 to the k. Okay. So the k greater than 2 bounds are well separated. Is there an entangled sat phase? And, you know, it would be nice, right? That's a neat, that would be a neat phase. It would be saying that there's some finite region in this alpha parameter where there are thermodynamic graphs, which I know have zero energy states, and they're strictly entangled. They are not product states. And there aren't any product states in those zero energy states. And so there's some numerics for small sizes, which suggests this actual transition is about 1. That's not very compelling. But in fact, there it is. My yes disappeared. Yes, there is. And this is a very recent result, which exploits the quantum Lobach lemma, which was just proven a couple months ago. And what the quantum Lobach lemma tells you is that there are, in fact, if I have bounded degree in my interaction graph, and that degree is bounded by something roughly of order 2 to the k, I could explain this in more detail if anybody wants, but let's leave it at this for now, then there are necessarily satisfying states. Okay? And the argument is actually very elementary. So the Lobach lemma classically is that it's sort of, well, we know that if I have a bunch of clauses that don't interact at all, then there's just some positive probability that if I picked a random state, none of them would be violated because none of the clauses overlap. And so the probability of finding a state that doesn't violate anything is something like, you know, 1/8 to the n, but it's finite, right? Or subcase, right? So the Lobach lemma allows you to relax that independence constraint on the clauses. And it says if you allow them to be arbitrarily dependent, but only on up to a few other guys at a time, then I still have a positive probability of having a state that satisfies. That's what the classical Lobach lemma does, and it's based on purely elementary sort of probability. The quantum thing says the exact same thing, and in fact, it's the exact same result when stated for the SAT problem. But it doesn't apply to this ensemble directly, because this ensemble has arbitrarily high degree clauses. So, in fact, what they showed in the... Julia Kempe, Andres Sambinis, and Orr Sata showed was really neat. They took our result about the dimer covering states, used that for the high degree piece of the graph, and used Lobach for the low degree piece of the graph, and proved that, in fact, the SAT phase goes all the way out to order 2 to the k. It actually doesn't apply for k equals 3, but for k bigger than some number it does, and it goes out as 2 to the k, and that means that this regime from here to here is entangled SAT.
I wish I knew. So, this is my conclusion. Quantum satisfiability
is a quantum hard optimization problem. It can encode any problem in class qubit 1. Generic QSAT is as frustrated as possible. It's a graph property. We hope that random QSAT provides some insight into what makes QSAT hard. I haven't shown you any of those class transitions, clustering transitions. It'd be great to find them. For 2 QSAT, we can do the whole thing. For higher K, we get indirect arguments, which I told you about. The entangled SAT phase exists at higher K due to sort of sophisticated use of quantum Lovash, gluing together the two pieces, our dimer covering and their quantum Lovash argument is not trivial. That took them a couple months to sort out. And there are many open questions. Where is the actual unsat SAT phase transition? This isn't done classically either, but maybe you can work that here. What is the complexity of computing this generic graph function? This looks like a counting complexity. It looks a bit like a partition function. But we don't know what it is. Are there quantum analogs of those clustering and dynamical phase transitions, which I told you about? Is there a cavity method, which is how most people derive those clustering transitions that could be formulated for this QSAT problem? And in sort of the big reach, are there quantum generalizations of belief propagation, survey propagation? How would an adiabatic algorithm? So,
thanks very much. Thanks very much. I forgot to say in the beginning, this is a joint condensed matter quantum information talk. Any more questions for Chris? We've asked a few for
So if you like to somehow study entangled subregion, what kind of entangled state do you study? What if you like to somehow try to somehow study this entangled subregion, you have to ask them what kind of entangled state and what kind of ANDAs you like to do. Well, we have a lot of some ANDA state, like dissonance, valence bond state, or state, anything.
So it's a good question. There are some people who've been looking at, I don't know if anybody's really directly studied the entangled SAT states in this model yet, because it's pretty new to show that they're even there. It's been known for a little while, but if you tune the rank up, you can find sort of a critical rank where you expect the ground states to exist but to be entangled as well. And people have been studying it there because it's a little bit simpler for technical reasons. And the conjecture there is that some kind of matrix product state might capture it well, but it'll look more complicated on a random graph. So they were thinking on chains. I don't know. So, you know, it'd be nice if there was some, in fact, it's sort of a local-looking problem. There probably is some kind of natural tensor product or something that might represent it, but it's unclear. And
as far as I saw, there's no direct application of such argument to the matrix product state. Was there any?
No, it's not direct.
You really use the random nature of this the interaction, right? Mm-hmm. To get some generic.
Yeah. No, I don't really know how to. I don't have any really good ideas on how to study that, other than playing with it for a while and seeing if something popped out of it. Well, let's thank Chris again. So Chris is here till.